morning and welcome to Mountain Money on this blustery Monday morning. This is Doug Wells. My normal co-host, Larry Warren, is at a breakfast event hosted by Summit Sotheby's, where they are announcing their support for several nonprofits here in Park City. Larry's going to be joining us mid-show, and we wish him and KPCW well at the event. We've got a good show today. Our first guest is going to be Scott Sonnenschein. He is the author of Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Imagined. Your mother always told you that less was more, and according to Scott's research, she was right. Those were words of wisdom, and Scott's going to tell us more about why sometimes having less as an individual, as well as having less as a company, can be a good thing. Then our second guest is going to be Claire Rood. Claire is the Senior Managing Director of the Utah offices of CBiz, which is a national accounting firm. And one of Claire's specialties is advising clients who are interested in selling their business, oftentimes years before they're ready to sell their business. And we're going to talk to Claire about what types of things you should be doing if you're thinking about selling your business, whether that's in the next year or maybe if that's 3 or 4 years away. And then our final guest is going to be Courtney Johansson, the managing partner of 350 Main, as well as the Spur Bar and Grill. It went through a massive remodeling this past fall, open for the ski season. And they're, as the name implies, on Main Street, and we'll hear from her about those new changes. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we will be back in a moment. Please.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, introducing Apex Residences, 63 ski-through community residences located at Park City's expanded Canyon Village, with clubhouse amenities, heated outdoor pool, and in-house concierge. Information at apexparkcity.com.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We've got Scott Sonnenschein on the line. He is the author of Stretch, How to Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Imagined. Before we get to Scott, just very quickly, I forgot to give an update on the weather. Obviously, snow today, snow tonight, a little bit tomorrow. And then it warms up, the sun comes out, and then snow and possibly rain comes on Friday. Also, I-80 is looking pretty clear. Westbound and eastbound chains or four-wheel drive required just for trucks. Regular vehicles, no restrictions. So it looks like the road is pretty clear for your commute this morning. Scott Sonnenschein, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
So, Scott, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
It's Sonnenschein.
Sonnenschein. Okay, even better. I like that.
You can probably use that.
We could use that, although there's no sun or shine this morning here in Park City. We're a ski town, so snow is good. So, Scott, your book that you wrote, Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined, argues that oftentimes individuals and firms are better served having less resources than more. Why is that?
Well, when we have fewer resources, we put ourselves in a mindset of constraints. And oftentimes, when we have this mindset of constraints, it unlocks our ability to be more creative. So what research shows is oftentimes we impose a budget or we impose more time restrictions on things, and we come up with more innovative and better ideas. And to me, it's a really powerful idea because so much of what we do at work is conditioned around trying to get more resources, an additional team member, a larger budget, or even for ourselves, a bigger title. And what the research shows and what I talk about in Stretch is there's often a lot of benefits to using this less because of the creativity that it helps us use, where we give ourselves that license to do things less conventionally and often better.
Well, I want to get into the research, but I want to contrast the two mindsets that you mentioned in your book. You talk about stretching, and the other is chasing. What is chasing, and why does it sometimes have a negative effect?
Chasing is the idea that the more resources we have, the better results that we'll get. And the problem with chasing is that it displaces us from the goals that we actually care about, because instead of focusing on our goals, we focus on just trying to get more and more resources, and we lose sight of what our actual goals are. Chasing also makes us unhappy because no matter how much we have, there's always going to be someone with more. So we keep escalating who we're comparing ourselves to. So we might get another person on their team or a larger budget, and then we'll want to compare ourselves to the person who has even more. And that becomes our whole way of life and our whole way of working. Well, meanwhile, we're overlooking the actual goals that we do care about.
So let me ask you, you just said, and I think I'm quoting you pretty closely, chasing makes us unhappy. You're a professor, you do research. That's a pretty broad statement. What does the research show? Is that actually a clinical fact, or is that just a caution?
Right. What the research shows is when we look at things called social comparisons, and there's a good reason why we make social comparisons. We help understand ourselves relative to other people, but there's also a dark side to social comparisons, and that dark side is when we make what are called upward comparisons, those who have more than us, it often makes us feel bad because we feel inadequate, and then what happens is we try and resolve that by getting resources to move up in status. But the way I like to explain this is it's like a treadmill where you can turn up the dial on the treadmill and the machine will actually go faster, but you're actually not getting any farther. So as you keep making these comparisons, it saps away your satisfaction.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a caution. And it's, you know, Park City is an affluent town, and I have two teenage daughters, and it's one of the lessons I try to impart on them. It is so dangerous, and it doesn't matter how high up you get. The comparisons never stop. I went to Stanford Business School, and when I graduated, I was raising money for a startup, and I was in a potential investor's office. And he had a picture of a corporate jet in his conference room while I was waiting for him. So when the potential investor came in, I asked him about the jet, and this is in the days before net jets and shared jets, so you actually had to own a jet. And he was obviously quite proud of it, thus the picture in the conference room. But then he mentioned that another investor who had referred me to him had an even larger jet. And it was that day in 1995 that I said, you know what, I have to get out of the Bay Area. It's just not healthy.
Right, because there's a great example of that chase. It's never going to end. And then, you know, it goes from who's got the private jet to who's actually got the passenger jet that they've outfitted for their own personal use. So these comparisons never end. But what's important is in the book Stretch, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be trying to achieve great things. Actually, it's quite the opposite. What I want us to do, though, is think about what is it that we really are trying to achieve. You know, for some people, maybe it really is getting the biggest jet. But my sense is for most people, it's not. And if you look at some of the very successful business people I profile in the book, they built, you know, in some cases, multi-billion-dollar businesses by following this stretching approach, recognizing that if they focus on what their goals are, success will come. But they're not motivated and they're not orienting their businesses and their lives around chasing after things. They're running their business and success follows.
So, Scott, let's talk about some of these stories. I think oftentimes they help this research come alive and help illustrate the point in a very powerful way. One of the examples you have in your book is the cheapest CEO in the United States. And I'm a frugal guy, so that caught my eye. Tell us about the cheapest CEO in America.
So Bob Kierlin, who started a company called Fastenal, which is a multi-billion-dollar industrial supplies company, started his business embracing frugality. And he grew up in hard times, and this was instilled in him as a child, and he realized he wanted to start his business on the same platform of values. So he took away some traditional perks that you would have in the office. So you travel for work, and he doesn't reimburse your meals because he would argue you have to eat anyway. And he follows this too. It's, you know, he would take road trips instead of, he certainly doesn't have the corporate jet, instead of flying. His office had very sparse furniture. But at the end of the day, he's using that money that he's saving, and he's helping expand his business. He's rewarding employees with more opportunities and bonuses. And he's creating this culture that people feel that they own the business and they have a stake in the business. And I should point out, he's a very generous person, although he often gives anonymously, not preferring to have recognition for his generosity. And if you were to have invested $2,100 in the day that his business IPO'd, and then took that until he retired about 20 years later, which was in 2014, that $2,100 would have grown to about $1 million.
You know, and another company that if you invested $2,100 in 20 years ago, you would have done very well is Amazon. Obviously just killing it in the retail space. And people might be surprised to hear that Jeff Bezos' organization is extremely Spartan. Their offices are not glamorous at all. Did you look at Amazon and potentially the role that frugality has played in helping them?
I don't have Amazon in the book, but they are known for being a very frugal organization as well. And you know, a lot of startups start the same way, where they're in the kind of HP garage startup. But what happens is, as they get older and they mature, they want to show that they've made it. So they move into the really big office building that's very grand. It has expensive furniture in it, because that's their signal of showing the world that they made it. And the ironic part, of course, of this is they abandon those things that made them successful, the frugality, the resourcefulness, the stretching, as they get older, and they lose sight of those values and those practices that made them successful. And then sometimes they often flounder. And you see this right now a lot in where you came from, in Silicon Valley. If you look at the culture there and the environment, in many respects, it looks familiar to when I was there during the dot-com boom and bust, where you have a lot of chasing after more and more venture capital, trying to grow into these huge organizations on using business models that aren't necessarily sustainable. And you've got to wonder how much time that area has left in this current cycle.
Well, I suspect they have a lot of time left, but we'll see which route that ends up going. You know, I want to talk about this balance between spending money wisely at the corporate level, this frugality, what some people would call cheapness, but then also being generous outside of the corporate workplace. One of the things you talk about in your book is not just the business impact of stretching, but how to live a happier life personally. And you mentioned that one of the downsides of stretching is potentially being cheap, being too cheap. How can people protect themselves from that?
Right. There's an important distinction to be made between being frugal and being cheap. When we're being cheap, we're literally psychologically pained from spending money. And this is not a token to a good life. You're not going to enjoy some indulgences. And my recommendation is not that you should deprive yourself of things. It's that you should just be mindful of your goals. So you're not going to spend money on indulgences. You're not going to invest money to grow your business. And you need money to often grow your business. So that's being cheap. Being frugal, you are psychologically pleasured from using money and other resources wisely. So it's a big difference, the pain avoidance versus the pleasure seeking. So when we're stretching, we're being frugal, we're taking that nice positive high that we get from knowing that we've used resources in a effective way as good stewards of our resources, but we don't want to be cheap and not make investments in either our business or take indulgences ourselves. At the end of the book, I have some caveats, and I profile an investment banker, head of an investment banking firm, who has taken cheapness to an extreme, where he's overdone it, and he lives in a dilapidated house that has mold in it, and his wife didn't want to live with him because the house was in such shambles. He can easily afford to fix the house and to fix the leak in the roof, but he chooses not to, I think, because of
it causes
the cheapness
pain
versus the frugality.
Yeah, because of the cheapness. So it's likely not a surprise to you that folks like Bezos and the CEO of Fastenal, while being frugal on the business side, are pretty generous outside of that world. You also give another caution for stretching, and that is it can be easy to cross the line and set your expectations too high, which can have negative effects. Tell us how we can protect ourselves from that.
Right. expectations are important because when we expect more out of people, they tend to live up to those expectations. But there's an important caveat. Are those expectations believable by the person that you're setting them for? If they are believable, you get this nice self-fulfilling prophecy, and the research shows you can make children learn more, you can have employees be more productive. But if those expectations are not credible, they're not believable by the person who you're setting them for, it turns into performance pressure, and you end up choking. So it's not simply about, I think you're going to be terrific, and you set these high expectations, but it's a bunch of platitudes without any real semblance tied to reality. That's not going to work.
You know, we were talking about Silicon Valley earlier, and one of the things that it's famous for is giving young people opportunities to be CEOs, to be the leader of companies at a very young age. You look at Mark Zuckerberg, famously 19 when he started Facebook. Even you know, Steve Jobs, 20 years old when he started Apple, and obviously had some setbacks and came back later. But you know, what's the risk? How much of this balance comes from life experience, and how do you help a young CEO maybe navigate these choices in a wise way? And wisdom often comes, unfortunately, with years.
Right. So oftentimes, it's people who have different set of experiences that are able to come up with the most interesting and novel ideas. And I think the example of Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs are prime candidates for that because they're approaching problems in different ways, which is why they can be innovators and come up with disruptive technology. So there's a lot to be said about putting people in leadership positions in organizations that look different than the typical type of leader that you would get because they have a different experience. And Steve Jobs was famous, of course, for saying that, you know, what really separates someone successful from someone random on the street is the bag of experiences that they carry with them into the office. So the more diverse experiences that we can get, the more effective that we can be. So when it comes time to being a green leader who might be on the young side, obviously you have challenges because some of your employees might be older than you. Many of them might actually be older than you. They might have more experience, but you also come with another set of assets, which is a different type of perspective and maybe a different set of experiences that can help you see problems differently and frame them in more helpful ways for your employees.
Excellent. I want to get back to some more examples that you have in the book. One of my favorites was Netflix. You know, I mentioned Amazon earlier. They've taken over retail space. Netflix is just such a powerhouse. If you look at the amount of time people are spending on Netflix, in many ways, it's become the entertainment of choice for mainstream America. And part of the power is there's just so many shows now. And one of the things Amazon pioneered is this recommendation engine. It primarily uses machine learning. People think of that as a space that is owned by people with PhDs in statistics and very high math, difficult math expertise. But when Netflix wanted to improve their recommendation engine, they set out what was known at the time as the Netflix Prize, which was $1 million to anybody that could improve the recommendation engine by 10%. And there was a surprise contender, a guy that called himself a guy working in a garage. Tell us his story and how he was able to do more with less.
Gavin Potter is such a fascinating person because obviously, the Netflix Prize attracted a lot of attention, and you had these well-known scientists with PhDs from prestigious universities all piling on to this competition, not also because of the prize, but also the prestige of solving one of the greatest mathematical challenges, which is, you know, how do you improve this recommendation system, which is based off of all this computer algorithm, and there's a lot of data points that they were provided. So everyone was entering. I think there were over 1,000 entries that were in there. And Gavin Potter was he didn't end up winning, but he was in the top 20. And part of his solution ended up shaping the winning solution. And he was simply a unemployed psychologist at the time in England, and he didn't have any fancy equipment. He had a oldish Dell desktop computer. He used his teenage daughter as a mathematics consultant to help him with some of the math, and he ended up coming up with a really important insight that most people were missing in the competition, which is that it's not simply a math problem that people are trying to solve. They're trying to solve a problem of human behavior, because when people are deciding which movie they want to recommend, they want to watch, or how they rate those movies, it's not actually just how much they enjoyed the movie. They were also being influenced by what they had previously watched and rated. And Gavin Potter had remembered this from his psychology training. It's what the behavioral scientists Tversky and Kahneman talk about anchoring, how we get anchored off of things that are irrelevant. So whether or not I liked a movie that I watched before another one really shouldn't have any logical bearing on how I rate that next movie. But it does. And Potter recognized that if we think about this not just as a math problem, but we think about it more broadly as a human behavior problem, we can look at some new data and some new patterns. And he brought that to the Netflix prize, and that helped him move up to the leaderboard and ultimately have that part of his work make it into the final solution.
You know, I love that story because it gets back to the point you were talking about earlier, which is the power of diverse experiences, right? It was his background as a psychologist and knowing this anchoring that allowed him to get to an insight that in his case, the prize was if you could get a 10% improvement. And I believe in your book, you said he got like 9.5 or 9.6% improvement from that insight. So he was really close, but not quite far enough to get past that the bogey to win the prize.
Yeah, and I should point out that it took several, you know, Netflix's own experts couldn't even come close to those numbers that he put up, and it took several years for the winning teams to actually break the 10% mark. This was not
an overnight type
of thing. This was things that people invested lots of time to try and crack, because it's a pretty hard problem.
It was a big deal, and there were several different teams. They ended up, because of the power of diversity, having teams. And there were several teams that were at the 9.5, 9.8, 9.9, but getting to 10% was pretty hard. We've only got time for one or two more questions, and I want to ask you a question about your personal experience, actually. You opened the book in the introduction talking about your personal experience at a venture capital-backed firm in the Bay Area called Vividence, which was a high flyer in its day. It had raised $50 million in venture capital from brand-name VC firms, and I don't want to talk about the experience there, but the impact when that company went under in a spectacular fashion, and you were one of the team players, you were not the leader there, but it caused you to do a lot of introspection of what was important in your life and what you wanted to do professionally. You know, Park City is a place where a lot of people move after they've had a level of success in their lives, and now they're thinking about the next chapter. Share some insights. What was useful for you in hindsight as you look back at that period? What helped you make a good decision as you were pondering the next chapter of your life?
Yeah. We often go through these motions of trying to follow what we think the conventional path should be. And in my case, I came to Silicon Valley because that seemed like the thing that you should be doing in, you know, the late 90s, the turn of the century. And then it often has this turning point where you have some type of event. And, you know, the decline of the tech market really got me thinking, well, how does this really fit into my life plan? And do I see myself really wanting to do this? And oftentimes what happens when we get caught up in chasing is we forget what our actual goals are. So for me, I was out there and the organization was existing. It was just trying to suck up as many resources as possible. And I was just as guilty and, you know, trying to go through this accumulation type mindset. But it took this outside event to get me thinking and asking, you know, how do I really want to spend my time? And I think there's a lot of courage that you need to do when you kind of come off this path, because again, people look at you, and I had some cover, of course, because the whole industry was collapsing, but lots of other people might find themselves doing things that they're not enjoying or working in an organization whose mission they don't necessarily support. And it takes courage to try and step outside and have an honest conversation with yourself and ask, is this how I actually want to be spending my time? I mean, is this how I want to what type of career I want, and is this the type of impact that I'm making? And if you don't have that honest conversation, I think a lot of us are afraid to have that conversation because we don't like the answer that we're going to give ourselves. But if you actually spend time and have that conversation with yourself, I think a lot of us would probably make different choices.
Well, thanks for sharing that viewpoint. It's funny, in the last 2 weeks, I mean, you're a professor at Rice University, and 2 weeks ago I had a friend tell me one of his friends was visiting from Rice University, and I believe you guys know each other, Andre Hodge.
Yeah.
Also at Rice University. She was out here on vacation and just a naturally curious person and wanted to find out what was going on here in Park City from a business standpoint. So I enjoyed meeting her, and I've enjoyed chatting with you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest this morning has been Scott Sonnenschein. His book is Stretch, Unlock the Power of Less, and Achieve More Than You Ever Imagined. Thanks again, Scott.
All right, thank you.
You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. It's obviously snowy today. It's going to be snowy tomorrow, and then a couple days of cloudy and or sunshine before snow and or rain returns in the weekend. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Support for KPCW comes from Crandall Capital with New Park Town Center. With urban amenities and services and home to restaurants, shops, entertainment, lodging, and residences. More information about New Park Town Center at 801-303-5440.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next guest is Claire Root. Claire is the Senior Managing Director of the Utah offices with CBIZ, which is a national accounting firm. And one of Claire's expertise is advising companies on what they need to do to get ready to sell their company when the day comes, and actually hopefully before the day comes. Claire, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So let's start with that opening statement that I just made. You know, what company owners need to do when the day comes, and possibly quite a bit sooner than that. Why is it important to plan ahead of time for the sale of your company?
If you plan ahead of time, the sale of your company can be maximized, and the key is to be prepared and be ready so that when the time is right, the company is in good shape, you can demand maximum value, and you have the ability to transition that value to the purchaser. And in order to do that, you need to have a bit of a lead time and make sure you plan ahead.
What type of things do people need to do during this plan ahead period?
The first thing we focus on is their enhancing the value or maximizing the value of the company, and that immediately drives us to the financial systems and processes involved in the company. And so we make sure that we understand their systems, that it's accurately reporting the income, the current assets of the company, and thus can be interpreted by suitors to have significant value. So we start with the financial side.
Great. And, you know, over the last decade, I think Utah's done a very good job of fostering entrepreneurship. We've had some very nice success stories here in Utah. And one of the things, and actually our previous guest was talking about that, I think Utah entrepreneurs benefit from is being scrappy, doing things themselves, getting more done with less. And that can also foster a do-it-yourself mentality. And I think sometimes people make a mistake when it comes to selling their company. They think they can do it themselves. What are some of the key professionals that folks should have around them as they're thinking about selling their company? And why is it important to invest in that versus do it yourself?
There's a team that needs to be brought together. It usually consists of course, the owner and key personnel in the business. Then it would be the CPA that understands the business and has a background able to contribute. Then also the attorney is incredibly important. And oftentimes they have attorneys they work with. Sometimes they want attorneys with specific transactional skills. So we help to pull that team together. By using these professionals that do this day in and day out, they're able to find companies that might be strategic buyers. They can explore a variety of options. There may be an internal option where management might want to buy the company. We can weigh that against having a strategic buyer or even just another person in their market that's interested. And there could be family succession that's involved. So all this becomes complicated, and with experience, we can help walk them through. And the whole key is it should be a value proposition for them. If the advisors can't show that they're bringing value to the table, I have a sympathetic ear to those entrepreneurs. We need to be able to demonstrate the value that we bring to the team.
Yeah, you know, I work in the money management industry. I would add to that list that you just shared, you know, the attorney, the accountant, and probably a money manager sooner rather than later, because there are some estate planning strategies that you should know about. There's some gifting strategies that you should know about. And let's talk about the gifting strategy. Oftentimes, people wait to surround themselves with their professionals until they have what's called a letter of intent, which is when a company has said, hey, we're interested in buying your company. Let's talk about the gifting strategy. If somebody is charitably inclined and they wait too long into the sales process before they start thinking about making a charitable donation, there's an important gifting strategy that they miss out on. Tell us about that.
Well, if you do not plan ahead and put some gifting strategies in place, once that letter of intent is signed, well, you're oftentimes are not able to get a gift equal to the fair value of the stock or ownership interest that you desire to give to charity. Once there's a letter of intent, well, then the IRS will deem that the sale took place and that you're actually going to give cash after the sale versus an asset that has appreciation, and you can gift it before triggering tax, and that's incredibly important. You can have the appreciation be gifted to the charitable organization, and it is a very wise and efficient way to give to charity.
Claire, I want to introduce you to Larry Warren. He's my co-host. He missed the beginning of the show, but he's now stepped in. I know he has a couple questions for you as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, Claire, good to meet you. One question I have is just how much of selling a company depends on tax law? I mean, can you just look at a prime time to sell, or does the tax code dictate when and how you sell?
I always recommend that the tax code not dictate how and when you sell. We should be planning well in advance, and there are methods to structure transactions that can mitigate the impact, even in a less advantageous environment. If we happen to be in a higher capital gains rate environment, or if we happen to be in an environment where it's a little more difficult from a tax perspective to sell, there are still many, many strategies and many ways, if you plan ahead and are able to take some time in planning for the transaction, and then you don't have the tax code driving the transaction. You can do it when it's time for the owners, when the succession is right.
And another thing that seems to happen quite often is in a self-made business, that transferring it to the second generation or the third becomes difficult to impossible, and some families lose their businesses because they can't afford to transfer it to the next generation? How do you, you know, what's the issue there, and how do you get around that and assure that succession if you want to keep it in the family?
Sure. You're absolutely correct. Family-owned businesses comprise about 90% of the business enterprises in North America. And of that 90%, only about 30% will pass on to the second generation, and then only about 12% pass on to the third. And by the fourth generation, there's usually only about 3% that are still owned by the business, by the family. To help increase the probability, what we need to do is make sure that the family is planning long in advance for this succession. We work with some families 10, 15 years in advance, knowing that this is an objective that they have. They want their children to be primed and ready to go if they want to. And so some children don't want to, and that's okay. But having the ability to identify that those that are interested in the business, getting them the right training and skills along the way, the education that's necessary, it's very important. And then there's some financial planning along the way that can prepare for the day and have a funding mechanism available when those the next generation is ready to take over. And that's a process. Sometimes it just takes many, many years to have that happen. And it also isn't one size fits all. You find out that these are very dynamic plans, and many times they'll be customized as you go and as the desires of the current owners and then also their successors change and evolve.
So, Claire, let's talk about the other side of Larry's question. Larry was asking about passing it down in the family, and you mentioned how few companies actually make it to the third or fourth generation. I think the audience might be surprised to learn the same thing happens if you have a liquidation event. The kids don't go into the business, and now you have a nest egg. And the ability to do some legacy planning, which I think is important to a lot of folks that have spent their lifetime building a company. But I think folks would be surprised how challenging it is to pass down those values and the positive impact that can come from a payday like this. What are some things people should know to maybe maximize their likelihood of being able to successfully pass down their values and the positive impact of this nest egg?
Well, a couple things come to mind immediately. First of all, the structure in which that you're using to help increase the probability of your success. Items you hear about all the time, but seldom are they explained or understood very well, are trusts, legacy trusts, grantor trusts, revocable trust, irrevocable trust. These are instruments that help and in the right situations can increase the probability that you're going to have success in passing on the wealth and then also having that wealth continue on for generations. We also find that many of our clients are investing a lot of money in helping their families and their heirs to gain experiences that will prepare them for the day that they do have a significant amount of wealth that they are in control of. So they'll have either their own foundations. They can be private. They can also be sometimes just attached or support organizations attached to other foundations and other charities. And then sometimes it's just getting involved in the public charities that are out in the community and helping have a family involvement. And during that process, teaching heirs and children how to impact society and for good and to achieve some very wonderful things.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the toughest parts of that is, of course, you need to let your kids make mistakes too, and it's challenging to do that, but that's where really powerful learning can come from. We need to wrap up, but I want to close with this question, which is, I think as the audience is listening to you, you know, you look at the world in a strategic way. Which can be unusual for accountants. We're coming up on tax day. I think most of us, our day-to-day encounter with accountants has more to do with kind of the more on the bookkeeping end of things, you know, filing taxes properly, having the right financial reports. How can folks find a strategic accountant to help them think about things they should be doing so that in 3, 4, 5 years, they're in a better place than they are today?
Keep searching. First of all, ask the questions. Get the accountants involved. So meet with them and talk about strategies. Talk about objectives. Talk about what your goals are. And in doing so, get the feedback from the accountants and see how vested they are, how interested, how much they can bring to the table. And then if they aren't that type of an individual and they're you know more comfortable in working the numbers and not providing foresight or planning or strategy, well then keep looking. You can ask other individuals. Most people, wealthy families, successful individuals have found strategic advisors that they feel very comfortable with. And so I'd say start with a good referral from a good friend.
Okay, that's great advice. Claire, thank you for joining us this morning.
Bye now.
Our guest this morning has been Claire Rude. He is a senior managing director of the Utah offices with CBIZ. We appreciate him spending his time with us this morning. And coming up next is Courtney Johansson. She is the managing partner of 350 Main, as well as the Spur Bar and Grill. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with us.
Gordo here.
And I'm Larry with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
Since 1974, we've been part of this community with shared ride, private van, and SUV service for our customers.
Reservations available at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, heading to a high of just 26 today, but then the warming trend for the rest of the week, the dreaded warming trend.
The R word, maybe.
Yeah. Courtney Johansson is in the studio with us now. She's managing partner of 350 Main Brasserie and the Spur Bar and Grill. And Courtney, we wanted to have you in to talk largely about the Spur, because over the fall, and I kept looking and wondering, are they going to get it done by ski season? It must have been a nail biter.
It was stressful. We had a wedding, actually, on December 2nd, and so that was the drop-dead date. And so we actually got occupancy on December 2nd at 4:45.
For a
in
5
the
o'clock
afternoon
wedding.
For a 6:30 wedding. So
that's calling it close.
Yeah, there was a lot of tears shed that day.
And not
sure.
Just by the bride.
No. Yeah, I gave him an option to go to 350 on Monday and said, you know, we're not getting the windows in until Thursday. You guys can still move it. They're like, no, we trust you guys that you'll get it done. We're like, okay.
So what did that do to the Spur? It brought you forward. This was, whose space was this before?
It was Dugan's West.
Okay.
That was the t-shirt shop that was on the Main Street side of the Spur. And they had two shops on Main Street. So they were, you know, getting a little bit older and felt like just going down to one shop was, you know, a good decision for them. And it was time for us to be able to grow. We were, you know, had hit a plateau basically with the business at the Spur. You know, with the backspace, there's not a lot of natural light. You know, it's a great live music venue, and that's what we want to keep and stress, you know, very heavily that part's still there, but we needed to be able to grow as a company.
And then you went up a story as well.
We did. you know, I feel like with this town, there's, you know, you're as busy as you can be for 3.5-4 months a year, but there's a lot of other months in the year that people, you know, want a space to go hang out in, a cool space. So the second level was really driven for that.
And you probably haven't really had a chance to test it out, but it has a nice outdoor deck that's going to be killer in the summer.
It does. So it's got a sliding glass door across the whole face of it. So that thing can open all the way up. So not only do we have the outdoor patio, but the entire upstairs space becomes a big open air dining space. So about 150 people fit up there. So it's pretty cool. And we really want to, you know, see what that's like in the spring and summer for everybody.
So I'm curious, does your company own those buildings or are you tenants?
My dad owns the buildings. Okay. So I am a tenant of my dad.
Well, you know, you're in a special situation then, because Larry and I have talked with merchants on Main Street, and it's getting to be very difficult out there because the rents are rising now. Given that your dad, I'm sure he's taking it a little easier.
No, absolutely not.
No family discount.
No. Our rent is based on a percentage of sales, and when I tried to negotiate that percentage down, and I tried to ask some people around town who are based on percentage. There's a lot of restaurants that are like that. We're right in the mix with everybody else. Trust me, I've tried to work my magic trying to get that number down, but, you know, maybe someday it will be mine, but not right now.
I need to learn some lessons from your dad. I've got two teenage daughters, and I need to toughen up a little bit.
Yeah. No, I wish I had a break on that, but,
okay,
you know.
So now the spur that we're all familiar with is the back side. Is it connected to the front side?
It is.
Is that one big venue now?
It is. It's one big venue. So we still have live music 7 nights a week in the backspace, the old spur, if you will. Mm-hmm. You don't access it down the alley anymore. You access it just right off Main Street. And if you want to go to the live music space, the old spur, you just walk straight back. There's a, you know, an 8-foot hallway with it. It's not like walking down a
little
tunnel.
So it is kind of like two different spaces.
It's really three different spaces. You know, we've got the front bar, the back bar, and the upstairs bar. So there's, I really feel like there's three distinct different feels, you know, to the spur. And again, my husband and I run it, and it was sort of our vision to do the expansion. And, you know, before we had kids, we went out a lot, and there was a lot of things that we wanted to see and things that we liked that we felt like this town was missing. And so that's sort of what we brought in, the upscale kind of bar food and a place where you can sit down and a place where you can party and the outdoor space, all these different things that we felt like, you know, was lacking just a little bit. And we knew that we could bring the customer service part of it, because that's what we've done with 350 and the Spur all along. And we brought in a great chef. And so it was just kind of this combination that we wanted to see that, you know, maybe we hadn't seen as much in this town yet.
So Courtney, you opened with the nail biter of the wedding, the pending wedding. I don't think of the Spur Bar and Grill as a wedding venue. Is that something that happens fairly regularly?
It went into the planning of the space. We, with the upstairs, with the sliding doors coming out, I feel like it would be an amazing space for if you wanted to have a true Main Street
wedding. You want to have a party wedding.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Is that fair?
Party wedding or even just a Main Street wedding. You know, from our balcony, you can see down the canyon. You've got a mountain view. You've got a Main Street view. And, we get a lot of destination weddings here, and people love Main Street. So, you know, but you're correct. We don't do the ceremonies as much, but we do a lot of receptions. We do a lot of welcome parties. It's like the new rehearsal dinner is called a welcome party.
What else do you guys do that maybe the folks here in Park City currently don't think of the Spur Bar and Grill for?
Well, our hours are expanded, so we're open at 10 a.m. every day. We've got a few items that are, our whole menu is served all day and all night. And on the menu, there are some breakfast items. So I don't think that people would peg the Spur necessarily as a breakfast place.
I never think of that as
a place for
eggs.
Yeah. We've got some breakfast items that are all, you know, an all-day breakfast. So if you, you know, go out hard dancing at the Spur the night before, you can come right back and sit upstairs on the balcony and get yourself some breakfast.
Okay,
go ahead.
Well, during Sundance, I read about this event. I wasn't there. You had the remaining members of the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, we did.
Playing on your
stage.
Stage,
yeah.
Wow.
For about 150 people. It was insane. Woody Harrelson got up and sang a couple songs with them, and then the remaining three, I think, I'm not super hip to the Grateful Dead game, but yeah, they were there. It was a huge deal. It was completely private, which was a bummer for a lot of people who lived here were trying to get in.
Yeah. Well, just mention a little bit about the food. You say you upgraded it, added some breakfast menus. So what's the theme of the food? Bar food or better?
It is. It's bar food elevated, I would say. We're using Wagyu beef for all of our burgers. Our chef is named Chris Parker. He's been around town for a while. He also was in Maui for quite a while. He's got, an incredible way of presenting his food. You know, we've got some sort of fancier items like some lobster fritters and a crab and artichoke dip, but we've also got the traditional wings and the spur burger, and then we bought a pizza oven a couple years ago, and so we make some awesome kind of gourmet flatbreads.
Bar food elevated. I like that. Yeah. For a state that is known as Life Elevated, that's a great slogan for you guys. Our guest this morning has been Courtney Johansson. She's the managing partner of 350 Main as well as Spur Bar and Grill. Courtney, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks, guys.
And we will come back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel. 565-4730, ParkCityAirCruiseAndTravel.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, ParkCityBikeDemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Doug, a little late this morning, but thanks for covering the first half. I was over at the Summit Sotheby's Monday morning sales meeting where they were awarding the Sotheby's Cares checks, donations from their agents and the company itself to the nonprofits of Park City. And it was a fun event, always fun to be recognized by others for the work we do.
And I asked you off air, KPCW is one of the benefactors of that generosity, so we thank them for that.
Absolutely. And in addition, they really take pledge drives seriously. And we had 41 plus calls from them in an hour, which is amazing call volume, and raised a lot of money during the last pledge drive, as we have for the last many, many drives.
Yeah, they're an impressive organization. We thank them for their support of the station. We also want to thank our other sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Group, Park City Mountain, and Apex Residences and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties.
And thanks to Scott Sunshine. He sounds like
his God-given name isn't Sun and Sheen, and he just decided to change the pronunciation. But him, we also want to thank Claire Rood, who is a senior managing director at the Utah offices of CBiz, and of course, Courtney Johansson with 350 Main as well, Spur Bar and Grill, who just joined us.
Yeah, and wow, how would that be to be one of 150 in the room with the Grateful Dead, those who are still standing, at least. We have winter weather advisory until noon, but it's clearing up nicely right now, headed to a high of just 26 degrees, and wow, was it wild winds last night.
It's the whole weekend.
Yeah.
Very blustery.
Well,
did
you go out skiing? I just, I did my taxes. I figured that would be more comfortable.
I did get out, but, you know, it was one of those storms where there was a lot of bluster, but not a whole lot of fluff that came with it, unfortunately.
Well, there's still a chance of snow through this evening. And then we're going to get in the dreaded warming trend. High Tuesday, 39 degrees. High Wednesday, 48 degrees. So spring is arriving, but then another blast of winter after that. Well, thanks for joining us for Mountain Money. We appreciate having you in the audience. This is KPCW Park City.